I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. We're going to be talking about climate change and the history of the EPA working on climate change in this country. Within a month, our guest writes, in the conversation of creation of EPA 46 years ago, President Nixon singled out, signed into law, rather, the 1970 law, and it granted the EPA into existence. Congress gave the new agency the mission to protect the public health and welfare from air pollution, and welfare includes effects on climate. The current administration has said they intend to roll back two pillars of the Obama administration's climate policy: regulations to limit emissions from vehicles and also from power plants. So we'll get a history lesson here, and we'll also talk about all of the legal decisions that have been made by Republican and Democratic administrations over the past almost 50 years looking at the issue of climate change. Who's in the EPA now? Also, of course, as a result of budget cuts, the EPA is getting a drastic reduction in their budget and not much of guidance to carry on with climate change research or to create climate change policy. Our guest this hour of the program is the author of the piece in the conversation, Professor Greg Dotson. He's an assistant professor of law at the University of Oregon, has worked on energy and environmental policy, and held senior congressional staff positions in the U.S. House of Representatives for 18 years. We already have a number of phone calls coming in. We'll be welcoming calls in just a little while. Our number is 800-486-8655. The email is ideas@wpr.org. We're on Facebook at The Kathleen Dunn Show and also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Professor Dotson, thank you very much for being with us. Good afternoon.
Kathleen, thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, our pleasure. It is amazing when I think about how almost 50 years ago, 1970, when Richard Nixon signed the Clean Air Act of 1970 into law. Isn't that something?
It really is. And I think, you know, what motivated me to write this piece was listening to the current discussion coming from the White House and the new EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt. You'd almost get the impression that EPA's work on climate change is just a recent diversion from its core mission. And I knew, having worked on climate change for 20 years, as you mentioned, both as a congressional staffer and then most recently as a law professor teaching climate change law and policy, I knew that characterization, you know, just wasn't accurate. And so I decided that I would write a short piece that would, you know, be easily digestible so people could understand the history of the agency and the really the bipartisan progress that has been made for a very long time.
Yeah. Scott Pruitt did say, and you remind us in the article, he characterized climate change as a recent diversion from the EPA's main mission, except that clean water and air and climate change go hand in hand, don't they?
They absolutely do. If you care about air quality, you should definitely care about climate change. And if you care about water, you need to think about climate as well. Not only in the case of water quality issues, but also quantity issues, because now we don't get water when we want it, and we get too much water when we don't want it. So, and these are some of the extreme precipitation events that scientists tell us will be increasing due to climate change.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, you probably know a good deal about the makeup of the EPA right now, and of course, there may not be a whole lot left to it if the budget cuts go through, because EPA is getting not completely defunded, but losing a lot of money. How many former staff members does Pruitt have from Senator James Inhofe, the prominent climate skeptic? He's serving under him. Are there a lot of climate deniers who are serving in the EPA now?
Yeah, increasingly. There's been a number of press accounts of these sort of policy folks in Washington, D.C. who have had their careers around the concept of minimizing concerns about climate change and arguing against action to address it. And it seems that these folks have really become the backbone of Administrator Pruitt's leadership at the agency. And, you know, and that's that is, of course, a big concern because, you know, you want an expert agency like the EPA to not have an ideological bent towards action. They are, you know, at their root, EPA is a public health agency. Mm-hmm. They are designed to, their mission is to protect, as you mentioned, public health and welfare. And if the leadership comes in with a view, an ideological view, which we can see demonstrated in their career histories, that they don't believe we should be taking action on climate change, then that can be very detrimental to the mission of the EPA and also to our success in addressing this challenge.
Let's start from most recent and move it back a bit. The Trump administration is planning on rolling back the Obama administration's policy on regulations to limit emissions from vehicles and also from power plants. President Trump was in Detroit last week and said that he has formally begun the process of reviewing the Obama administration's emission standards for vehicles. He told manufacturers in Michigan that the decision would grow jobs and help their bottom lines.
Yeah. So this is a great concern. I think, you know, essentially we had the automakers join together with the federal government and reached an agreement to improve the efficiency of light duty vehicles, so cars and trucks in the United States by 2025, and it's all using, you know, there's been a bit of misinformation about it. It doesn't require vehicles to be electrified. It doesn't prevent the people from having the access to SUVs or pickup trucks. It just says that if you're a manufacturer, no matter what size vehicle you build, that vehicle should become more efficient over time. And that way, SUVs can continue to be manufactured. They're just improving their performance just like small cars or other vehicles. These rules really save money for consumers. You know, a household that makes under $30,000 a year might spend 10% of its annual budget on gasoline.
Ooh.
And what the studies have shown is that with these rules in place, you can actually be saving thousands of dollars over the lifetime of a vehicle, even a larger vehicle. You buy an SUV, you could save up to $4,000 or even more during the lifetime of that vehicle. And the payoff can be, it depends on the vehicle, but it could be less than a year. So you might pay a little bit more, pays for itself within the year, and then you're just earning money back. So it's a real win for consumers. It's a real win for the environment because in addition to using less fuel, you're releasing less pollution. And doubling fuel economy you might be cutting pollution in half. And so a win for the consumers, win for the environment. And you know, the part about costing jobs, it doesn't really ring true with the past 2 years in which we've seen a very, very successful auto industry here in the United States. And there's nothing in these rules that disadvantage domestic automakers versus foreign automakers. So I think that I was disappointed to see that. I think people should be concerned about it. The real winners would be, of course, you know, fuel providers, because if consumers are saving money at the pump, that's money that's not going to oil companies who sell gasoline. And I think they are, more than anyone, very enthusiastic about this decision to reopen and potentially weaken the standard.
Mm-hmm. I think most people, the standards, or the goals, actually, it wasn't mandatory, but the goal of an industry-wide fuel economy standard of 54.5 miles per gallon by 2025, most people, be you a Trump supporter or be you a Democrat or whatever, you'd say, hey, that's a really good idea. I'd like to get that kind of mileage.
Yeah, it polls very well. The polling shows that the idea of more efficient vehicles is very popular with the American people. And with the Clean Power Plan, you know, prior to the Clean Power Plan, there was no limitation whatsoever on the amount of carbon pollution that could be emitted by a power plant. they could emit as much as they wanted to. And the Clean Power Plan, for the first time ever, put in rules that were based upon comments from over 4 million public comments and working closely with the utilities themselves. And it would cut the emissions by a little more than 30% by 2030. At the same time, oftentimes saving consumers money, because one way to achieve those reductions is through greater energy efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
So these policies are win-win policies, and it's disconcerting to see a retreat upon them.
And what about the regulations that the Obama administration put in place to limit carbon emissions from power plants?
Yeah, those are also, Scott Pruitt has been rather outspoken in saying that rule is going to have to go. And in eliminating that rule, it will mean that we would return, depending on what they do, we are expecting an executive order any day on this topic, so we don't know precisely what they will do. But he has essentially said it has to go, and if that rule is gone, then there will no longer be any limit on the amount of carbon pollution a power plant would be able to release.
Hmm. Take us, if you would please, Professor Dotson, a little history lesson here. You write in your article, presidents of both parties have called on the EPA more explicitly to act on climate change. Who said what when?
Yeah. Well, and if I might, I would just back out even more for a second and just say that we've known about climate change as a science and policy challenge for a very long time. You know, climate began receiving significant scientific attention in the late 1800s, and it first rose to the attention of the U.S. presidency in 1965. And as you mentioned, it's been part of EPA's mission and authority since the agency was created in 1970. So, and over that time, what we have generally seen is exactly what you would expect, an increasing focus and level of effort and ambition associated with it. So the government and then ultimately the EPA started off, they wanted to understand the problem. It was about research. It was about data collection. And then it moved on to enlisting voluntary help to try and address climate change, collecting better and better data to understand the problem, and then just in the last decade, setting some standards to guarantee results.
Mm-hmm.
So as you look back through time, I think we had in 1965, 5 years before EPA even existed, the President's Science Advisory Board presented Lyndon B. Johnson with a report entitled Restoring the Quality of Our Environment. And it had a 23-page description about the threat of carbon dioxide emissions and the risk it posed to the planet.
Back in 65.
65, yeah. LBJ released the report. He sent a message to Congress about it and mentioned the threat of increasing carbon dioxide. So 5 years later, when Congress, there was a sort of a two-step process. President Nixon signed a reorganization order to create the EPA. And in that, he talked about how he wanted to create an agency with a very broad mandate so that it could focus on issues that had not gotten sufficient attention at that time. But the 1970 Clean Air Act, which he signed into law, specifically mentioned that in protecting public health and welfare, EPA, who was now tasked with this job, was charged with preventing climate impacts as well. And some of the core statutory authority passed in that 1970 Act is what President Obama relied upon in issuing the Clean Power Plan. And that's not something that he sort of took a leap of faith on as much as relied upon what the Supreme Court has said when they indicated that that language specifically provided the authority to do so. So that was President Nixon during the Reagan years. I think I don't think people really looked back on President Reagan as a leader on climate change, but he did sign the Global Climate Protection Act. And what that did was it charged the State Department with being in charge with the international response to climate change, and it put EPA in charge of developing and proposing a plan, a domestic plan for climate change. When we got to George H.W. Bush, I think we saw really a step up in level of efforts on climate change. We knew more about it. He exercised presidential leadership, and he laid the groundwork and ultimately negotiated a successful international treaty to address climate change. It's called the Framework Convention on Climate Change, which pretty much every country in the world is now a party to. He also established a number of voluntary programs at EPA that were designed to help achieve the purposes of that treaty. And those that included a program that ultimately became EPA's Energy Star program, mm-hmm. which is essentially, people see it as a label when they go in and buy appliances, but you can also get homes that are Energy Star certified, and there's also a commercial element to it. It's a voluntary program, but it's one that's been very successful at preventing emissions.
And let's hear President George Herbert Walker Bush on the EPA. We're talking about environmental protection. We're talking about climate change, the future of the EPA and climate change. The Trump administration, our guest wrote an article about this, plans to roll back two of the strong points of the previous administration's climate policy regulations to limit carbon emissions from vehicles and also power plants. The EPA funding is going down some 30% in the current budget. Maybe that will change, but that's where it stands right now. The current head of the EPA has sued the EPA many times, and he has appointed former staffers of a prominent climate skeptic to serve in the EPA now. So we're looking at the history, what presidents have done, what policies have been initiated. And we'll welcome phone calls for our guest this hour. He is Greg Dotson, assistant professor of law at the University of Oregon. He worked on energy and environmental policy and held senior congressional staff positions in the U.S. House for 18 years. Our phone number, we'll go to you momentarily, is 800-486-8655. You can send messages on ideas at WPR.org. Our Facebook page, love to get your messages there. Always the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Before we start taking calls, here's what President George Herbert Walker Bush said about the EPA many years ago.
The United States is strongly committed to the IPCC process of international cooperation on global climate change. We consider it vital that the community of nations be drawn together in an orderly, disciplined, rational way to review the history of our global environment, to assess the potential for future climate change, and to develop effective programs. The state of the science, the social and economic impacts, and the appropriate strategies all are crucial components to a global resolution. The stakes here are very high. The consequences, very significant. The United States remains committed to aggressive and thoughtful action on environmental issues. We all know that human activities are changing the atmosphere in unexpected and in unprecedented ways. Much remains to be done. Many questions remain to be answered. And together, we have a responsibility to ourselves and the generations to come to fulfill our stewardship obligations. But that responsibility demands that we do it right.
Let's go to phone calls now. David in Ironwood. Hi, David.
Yeah. Me and my wife are actually going to Washington for that March on Science. And if you do a Google March on Science, Madison, Duluth, and many other cities are having marches too. So, but I compare President Trump to a bad used car salesman. have a $2,000 car. He demands $5,000, and you're talking to $3,000. And you say, "Hey, I got the $2,000." And he's sitting there saying, "Ha, I got those people to spend the extra $1,000." I mean, same thing. He wants to get rid of all EPA, and you know. And then we say, "Oh, we got half the good." And he said, "Ha, I got him to get rid of half of EPA." I mean, you got to watch what this guy is doing.
Why did you decide to march? You're going to Washington, David?
Yeah. Also, the Natural Institutes of Science is doing a Sjogren's study, my doctor thinks I have Sjogren's. So I'm going there to donate a whole day of my life to help find the cure for it. And you think that the Florida going under the water is the worst thing for global warming? The worst thing is if the oxygen levels in the ocean drop too far, the fish die, the anaerobic bacteria comes up, eats the dead fish, and the oceans go from making oxygen to making methane. That's the worst-case scenario.
Professor Dodson.
I think, you know, at the negotiating aspect that he just that the caller just mentioned about proposing a really extreme proposal and then and potentially resulting in still an unreasonable result. You know, the Trump budget basically that we saw last week proposes a 31% cut at
EPA.
That's
huge.
More than any other agency.
Is it? Ooh.
And that would basically eliminate 3,200 employees from the agency's 15,000 member workforce. So it's a really dramatic proposal. Former EPA administrator Gina McCarthy says it's essentially a scorched earth budget. That's an all-out assault on clean air and water and land. And, you know, interestingly enough, the Republican chairman in the House, who's in charge of the Appropriations Committee, has called this proposal draconian, careless, and counterproductive. So I think all eyes are on this budget because of its potentially very, very broad impact on EPA, not just on climate change, although they did target climate change in the budget, but in a lot of the other core aspects of what EPA does, whether it's grants to the states, whether it's the ability to respond to emergency situations or just carry out the fundamental core mission of the agency on all of these issues.
So when you sit down and try to figure out what's the philosophy behind this kind of draconian cut, well, what do you think it is?
Yeah, you know, I don't really have an answer for you, frankly. You know, the White House budget director, in announcing this, he said, as to climate change, and this is a quote, "I think the president was fairly straightforward. We're not spending money on that anymore." He said, "We consider that to be a waste of your money." And what doesn't really make sense is you have Donald Trump as a candidate being very negative on climate change, calling it a hoax. Once he became the White House, he said he was open-minded. His EPA administrator said there's a debate over climate change. Well, you would think that if you believe that there was actually a debate, you would want to answer any questions that were lingering, because the consequences are just too significant to ignore such a significant issue if all the scientists are correct. But instead, they're essentially eliminating all this information. We just heard the quote from President George H.W. Bush, and you know, he emphasized a lot of things, frankly, that President Obama might have talked about. The need for robust science, the need for international teamwork, the obligation to our children and grandchildren to get this right. And he endorsed the work of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the premier scientific body. Well, the Trump budget would eliminate all U.S. contributions to that research that they do, and it would also eliminate contributions to the international effort to engage other countries on climate change. So I have a hard time understanding how any of that makes sense, frankly.
David, thank you very much for your call. We go next to Pepin, who has further comments on the EPA cuts. Hi, Pepin in Milwaukee.
Hi. Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. When I first heard about these massive EPA cuts, I mean, I was concerned. I was really concerned. You know, I have a 3-year-old daughter, and I'm really worried about what sort of world she's going to get. And then I started scrolling through some comments on Reddit about the subject, And somebody pointed out that the EPA is also responsible for making sure we don't have, for example, large-scale industrial chemical disasters. And that really kind of kicked it up to a whole new level for me. I mean, I guess what I'm scared of is we're going to start seeing Bhopal-like events happening in America if the ability for the EPA to make sure to regulate that sort of thing goes away.
You know, I think that's I think it's a really good point. EPA does both emergency response and they do sort of systematic nibbling away at these very big issues over time. And I think it's very revealing that the Environmental Council of the States. So these are the state DEQs of all the 50 states and also territories. And when they saw these cuts, they were very concerned about it. They said the cuts to their programmatic grants from EPA, they get a lot of support from EPA, they're just untenable. And they say essentially that the federal government supports about a quarter, 27% of all the state's environmental activities. So you're not just damaging EPA's ability to respond to, for example, the algal bloom that happened in Toledo years ago, or a chemical facility incident, or other immediate disaster. You're undermining their ability to come up with long-term solutions to something like climate change, which is a multi-decadal threat. And you're also undermining the ability of the states to perform the work that we all expect them to do.
Is there any way for there to be a reversal of all of this policy? Is there any legal way? Is there Anything available?
The budget is very much a draft. It's a proposal. And, you know, I think it's very, when you have the Republican appropriators in Congress saying that they think it's careless and counterproductive, I think that's a sign that a lot of these provisions are going to be more closely scrutinized, even by members of his own party. Congress will have to act on this budget. This budget is not self-executing, and we'll know more about that in the months to come. With regard to the, there's an interesting aspect to this, which is that the EPA, in order to begin making standards for cars and for power plants, went through a process in which it had to determine that greenhouse gas emissions, carbon pollution emissions, actually posed a threat to the public health and welfare. And they did that through a rigorous process that I believe Scott Pruitt, as Oklahoma Attorney General, sued them on. But that process has been litigated. It was upheld. And so there is a standing determination about the threat carbon pollution poses to the nation. And overturning that will be very difficult because they would need to be able to prove to a court that there was some new information that reversed it. And I don't believe that they will be able to make that case if should they try to.
Thanks, Pepin, so much for your call. Nate in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I was going to bring up that with global warming going on, you've got the time period when wildfires happen expanding over the years. And right now you've got a real problem with wildfires in some of the plains states. And when a wildfire hits your home or your ranch or your farm, that costs, in the very literal sense of the word, that this is costing U.S. citizens. And I think it is remarkably questionable judgment to basically say at the time when this is actually hitting people and costing them stuff, we're not going to look at global warming. We're going to call it a waste of our time as the government that supposedly looks after its citizens. And on top of that, you can ask if this is sort of corrupt and that it's favoring one group over others in terms of fossil fuel companies over the population. And last but not least, I apologize to anybody, But I don't use the word skeptic because skeptics actually look at the details. I know that's what they are commonly referred to. But even now, you've got people who are trying to claim that we haven't been hitting record high temperatures in terms of the year that we just had.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a step beyond skepticism. It's trying to deny the facts. But I think that that is one more problem that we have with not looking at something as it is, like I said before, literally costing people.
Professor Dotson.
Well, I think that I would commend all, to all your listeners to look at a report called the National Climate Assessment. It was released in 2014, and it's a joint report. It's put out by the U.S. Global Change Research Program, and it's produced by EPA as part of the report, but it also includes work by NASA, by NOAA, by the Defense Department. And what that report does, it's required by Congress to be produced every 5 years, and it examines what is the threat to the United States from climate change. And then it goes further, and it says what are the threats to specific regions. And it talks about wildfires. It talks about the effects of sea level rise. It talks about the impacts of drought, extreme precipitation, all the effects that scientists are saying will increase due to climate change. And so I think you can learn a lot more about not only the nation as a whole, but also your individual region about the impacts that can happen. I think your caller is right about that. And I think he's also right to say that it's almost that we're beyond in some ways. There are probably people out there that have some legitimate skepticism, and they would benefit from learning more about the science that has been done. But there is also an active misinformation effort going on, and you see that in temperature records, where we are no longer understanding climate change based upon computer models. We are doing it based upon actual data and actual thermometers, and it can no longer be ignored.
And just by sight, right? Seeing what's happening in polar regions and the loss of glaciers, et cetera, it's phenomenal. It's hard for me to understand, so help me through this, who benefits by denying that all of this is going on, by relaxing standards, by not funding at a time when so many scientists, you know, I'm sure, and you as well know, the rapidity with which the climate is changing and the pretty dire consequences if we don't act on things. So now we're entering a time when we're rolling back on other executive orders, when we're not involved in international discussions on these important issues. I just don't understand, because it's for everybody's benefit. You don't have to be a Republican or a Democrat or an American. You can be from anywhere on Earth. It's important to all of us. So why not proceed on it?
Well, I think that there's been a fair amount of there's clearly the polarization that you describe that's occurred over the last 10 or 15 years on the issue. Back during George H.W. Bush's time, I don't think you saw it quite the same way that you do today. But there are some industries. I think the coal industry and the oil industry sees efforts to address climate change as perhaps an existential threat. And there's been efforts over the years to try to mitigate that, come up with develop technology that could be deployed so that those industries can continue to contribute. And everyone knows that they will continue to contribute for a period of time. But for an effective global response on climate change, we are looking at major reductions by mid-century in the developed world, and potentially even going to zero emissions by the end of the century. So that's big, and I think that those industries see that as something that's not consistent with their current business.
Right. Let's go next. Thanks, Nate. Sarah in Green Bay is our next caller. Hello, Sarah.
Yes, hello. Thank you. I would like to know, how much do the clean energy industries work in the coal mining areas to promote jobs? because these people really do not care what industry they work in. They just want jobs. So that would seem to be an ideal opportunity for the clean energy industries to develop these jobs.
Is any of that happening, Professor?
There was a large initiative in the last few years at the federal level to try to bring jobs to these parts of the country that have been historically dependent on coal mining, and I think that's one of the reasons that we've seen Republicans from Appalachia have, you know, come out very concerned about the recent budget proposal, because even those proposals designed to help coal mining areas have been slashed or proposed to be slashed in the Trump budget. So there has been some of that. I mean, I think you unfortunately get the industry sort of fighting amongst each other. For example, in Ohio, there was a proposal to increase the amount of renewable energy being used, and that obviously would lead to additional jobs in the state. But then that the legislature decided to, there's a turnover in the legislature from one party to another, and they decided to discontinue that policy. So, you know, as a way of courting, I think, the coal industry. And I think that's a real, you're getting these very, very specific state dynamics in which people are fighting about a limited pie rather than saying, how do we help everybody?
Thank you, Sarah, for the call. Jim in Hollandale is next. Hi, Jim.
Hi. It's funny that none of this subject has never been raised, and as far as I can remember, during this whole run-up to this election and for a long time before that, the single biggest threat to our environment, that's going to contaminate our environment enough to kill us, is agricultural pesticides, which are now being applied at enormous rates. Hardly anybody owns a cultivator anymore. And the farms keep getting bigger and bigger, and they can't get bigger and bigger unless they pour on the chemicals. And those chemicals are turning up in our food. And you continue to enlarge the size of farms, and the more chemicals you're going to use. And there's no discussion of agriculture at all on any front with regard to the environment, which there should be, because agriculture is a huge part of our environment. And it's also a huge part of our economy. And what's going on here?
What's going on here, Professor Dodson?
I guess I would just say that EPA has a pretty good program about pesticide residues in food. That doesn't get to the caller's concern about, you know, application and issues. And there are documented problems with this, I think, in various parts of the country. I don't really have a lot of insights to offer to it today, though.
We'll take more phone calls momentarily. Our guest is Professor Greg Dodson, Assistant Professor of Law at the University of Oregon. He has worked on policies related to energy, climate change, environment. He's held senior congressional staff positions in the U.S. House of Representatives for 18 years, and he is our guest this hour. And we're welcoming phone calls for him at 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is ideas@wpr.org. We're on Facebook, and that's the Kathleen Dunn Show, and also Twitter. And the Twitter is @KDunnShow. Oops, there we go. Well, so we'll take more phone calls momentarily. Let's go to Mike in Greenbush next. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Kathleen. I think I have three solutions.
Good.
First of all, instead of making the EPA change the automakers, do a free market system and have the customers walk into my Toyota dealership, and I said, I am really disappointed that you voted to water down the EPA fuel mileage standards. And I've had 5 Toyotas, and I said, that's the last one I'm going to buy unless you increase the fuel efficiency on your own without government intervention. Solution number 2, put a down payment on an electric Tesla car. because the biggest message you can send to the automakers is we're not going to buy your product. For people who can afford a Tesla, great. For those who can't, you know, drive less. Solution number three, renewables are not being done right in this country. The wind turbines that we have, not replacing coal, it's only replacing natural gas. The best thing to do with a wind electron is to charge a battery. And what is a battery? An electric vehicle. So we need to start focusing our wind industry along the corridors and replacing petroleum instead of natural gas, which is the only thing that wind is replacing. And when it comes to solar, the most cost-effective, environment-friendly use for a solar electron is to pump water. PV water pumping on a municipal scale so that when the sun shines, everybody who flushes their toilet, not everybody, even if it's 1%, flush their toilet in the city of Milwaukee are getting that water from the sun. And that's technical economics, and it's the real way to fight climate change.
All right. You've been thinking about this. That's good. Greg.
I think there is an amazing transformation that's been happening in our electricity sector over the last few years that your listeners may or may not be familiar with. It's true that when you're looking at the cheapest form of new generation to install these days, it's now natural gas competing with renewable energy. Coal is no longer the cheap option, which for many decades it was. And so we have seen the use of coal to generate electricity decline from almost half of, well, it was over half, maybe 15 years ago or so. And we've seen it decline from the far dominant source of fuel for electricity generation to around 35% or so. Last year, the largest new source of electricity installed was solar energy. So it's a quiet revolution that's happening, and it's happening because the costs of wind and solar have plummeted as the amount of generation capacity gets installed. It's just come down dramatically in price. So it's kind of an exciting issue because essentially it is the market that is beginning to change the way we generate electricity in this country. I think as far as vehicle standards go, I think that what we know about the way people understand or purchase new cars, oftentimes fuel economy is not the number one item that they think about when they're buying a new car, although it is one of the top items that determines whether they're satisfied with the vehicle over the long term. And it's a place, I think, that without some sort of intervention of minimal standards, you may not get as much improvement as would be possible.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Mike, for the call. Tom in Nelson, hi.
Oh, hello.
Hi, Tom.
Yes. I lived over in Germany back in the early 90s. I was working over there for 3 years. And now I've looked at stats, and I see that, you know, Europeans in general have energy consumption almost one-half of what the average per capita use is in the United States. And I know that the Europeans charge a lot more. For instance, the tax on gasoline was not 30% over there. It was 300%. Could you comment on the, you know, energy usage per capita in the U.S. versus other nations?
So there is historically been higher. That's been coming down. The economy, we're becoming more efficient in the United States, and that's due to everything from just more efficient appliances to, more systematic improvements. And it points to something that's happening globally, a dynamic that's happening globally, which is this is the third year in a row that we've had emissions stay flat even while the economy, the world economy, has grown. And in the United States, we saw from about 2008 to 2014, we saw the economy grow, I believe it was 8%, while emissions were cut by 14%. So these statistics show you is that economic growth is decoupling from pollution, and that's a really good thing for people to see. There were people who could theoretically project that years ago, and now we actually have real-world data. We're seeing it in the United States, and we're seeing it in Europe. And as the caller talks about, the in Europe, there has been a lot of progress on issues of climate and energy. It's interesting that Norway, I think, has basically phased out internal combustion automobiles. They've set a date
really?
Which no cars can be sold that are internal combustion. Sweden is apparently on the verge of passing a law that will say they're going to be carbon neutral, no net emissions, by 2045. These are the classic sort of Western European progressive countries, but the point, and Germany, which has a major diversified economy with lots of heavy industry, they have made a commitment to renewable energy that's really quite dramatic, and I think I think it's up to 30% or something on certain days of their power that's coming from renewable energy.
Yeah, it's quite remarkable. Thank you, Tom, so much for the call. Jeff in Medford, hi.
Hi, how are you, Kathleen?
Fine, Jeff, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks.
Good.
I just wanted to weigh in and preface my statements by my personal lifestyle is very, very efficient as far as recycling, using compost, not driving to places, and doing these types of, public entertainment like football games and that kind of stuff. So as I say this about Trump's budget and the EPA, I want to take that in context, and that is I think the government as a whole is so inefficient, and while we start programs with great intentions, they get bloated and they get so much bureaucracy and minutia into the details that they become ineffective and they counterproductive to what they originally were. So I think we need to pull back our government, get rid of a lot of this bloat, and then let's start choosing good things to do, because yes, we need to reduce our emissions. We need to be, and he just mentioned something that I wholeheartedly agree with, is we need to reduce our usage of electricity, our usage of vehicles, and that kind of stuff.
All right, thank you, Greg. Is it bloated?
I guess I would just say that the EPA budget represents 0.2% of the federal budget. It's a very small portion, and so a 30% cut of that is potentially crippling to the agency's current functions, while in the grand scheme of the budget situation, not having a very meaningful effect. And that's part of the fact that we do have a large budget for our government. But I would urge that what we are hearing is alarm bells from everybody who follows the agency in detail, whether it's scientists, whether it's the state regulators, whether it's EPA officials themselves or previous EPA officials. And so a more practical approach would be to say, let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater and then try and put back the pieces that we like. Let's determine what's important. And if climate change is important to us because we care about the future for our children, let's not defund that issue. If we care about the emergency response capability of EPA, let's not cut that and lose that capability and put those employees out on the street. Let's preserve these important functions going forward.
Thank you very much for being with us and for writing the article so it drew attention to you and we could have you on the show. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Greg Dotson, the piece that he wrote is The Conversation, and we have it on our Facebook page. We always like to direct you to a written piece about what we have been talking about, so that's on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Greg is an assistant professor of law at the University of Oregon. He has worked in lots of congressional staff positions in the U.S. House of Representatives for some 18 years on energies and issues, including climate change and energy and environmental policy. Thanks so much to Scotty Myers for producing this show and to Colleen Duvall for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Thanks for listening. Tomorrow we're with you again at 1 o'clock. At 2 o'clock is Hunting Morrow. We'll talk about that the second hour of tomorrow's show. News is coming up momentarily. Thank you for listening.